Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast made more or less for the exclusive use of the people of Harkol. That's in the star system Rifter, you know. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a saleable slice of English period effect charm vomiting green wallpaper paste from a paper mache rock face in a church crypt for this one.
As usual.
As usual.
As usual. And that means it's
all you need to know. What's the next story?
This year's two-part story, The Awakening.
This one's mine. Hurrah.
Do you like it?
Not at all. At the time, I thought, oh, lovely, shiny, Dennis Little, pretty fox. This is the 80s. This is totes 80s, kids. And we didn't even say that then. What did we say in the 80s?
Yeah, pretty much that.
Yeah, whatever it was. You still deal with young people.
Truly outrageous. Truly, truly, truly outrageous.
Is that what we said in the 80s?
That's okay. What Jim and the Hologram said.
I prefer the updated version that is also available on streaming that I don't think I can even mention on this podcast. In fact, I recommend you watch that before you watch The Awakening to get a real flavor of what the 80s was all about. Bea Arthur and cross-dressing. There's a lot of both of that kind of thing. I actually think that the face of the Malice is very much a Storgetty in the Golden Girls with the grey hair and the stony. Although looking a lot like Betty White as she is now.
Well, the guard who's defending Tegan, who is Joseph Willow, yes. When she won't change into the dress, he says, you change into it or I'll do it for you. Now, there's two ways to read that. Either he's being a bit rapey or he actually just wants to frock up and get out of these tights.
Yeah, no, he wants her to look fabulous.
Yeah. The Malice is actually more about pageantry and moristic self-throttling than it is wanting to take over. But when it wants to take over, it wants to do it with period drama. It's a very 80s villain. It really is mostly about overseas sales, this monster.
I actually think that it's doing a sort of Sapphire and Steel thing. You know, the issue is that there are anachronisms caused by the war.
Very Sapphire and Steel. And in that the past is always buried just under the present in some sort of alchemic relationship. Yeah. And with only the right incantations or the right thinking or reenactment process, you can bring the past and ghosts into the present.
And I also think that, like Sapphire and Steel, a lot of the special effects are just achieved with lighting and sound and, you know, a wind machine.
And barely paid actors.
And paid actors and maybe a couple of asterisks on the BBC micro screen superimposed.
When I was 10, those asterisks looked amazing.
Did they?
Did they? I'm glad they looked amazing at least once to someone.
You know, as a kid, it was really effective. And those simple lighting effects, especially in the second episode with all the apparitions that appear in the church, and so they're in sort of very pale blue costumes with very pale blue makeup and under a single spotlight. Mm. It's really quite scary.
We should point out to the listener at this point that Brendan exists outside of normal space and time
in his own
universe.
In that I quite enjoy this.
Well, but you were 10 when you first saw this, and I was 14 when I saw it go out for the first time.
Oh, yes, of course, because this is another one that I saw in the 1993 repeat season.
And Nathan, you saw it when it first came out as well.
Yeah, I saw it the same time as you, but I'd be surprised if I'd seen it very often since then.
Yes.
Maybe when I bought the DVD, I watched it again, but it's
the book. It's Eric Pringle, isn't it?
No. Mm.
It is Eric
I only
Pringle.
I know, the chips.
Yes, I know. He made a fortune. That's why he stopped writing. He made a fortune.
And now he's changed the size of the tin and you can't fit your hand in there and it's just ridiculous. Yeah. And I have tiny hands.
Well, I know where this is going. They're orange too.
So
not Brenda's, the chips.
So this started life as a four-part outline.
Yeah.
Which, for once, Eric Saywood said, there's not enough plot, make it two parts.
It could have been quite charming as a three-parter because it has some nice exposition. It's got Polly James! Polly James is one of the original Liver Birds with, go on, you get to say it.
Neris.
That's it, with Neris Hughes. What fun, what thrill. And Molly Sugden played the mother of one of them. back in the day. I remember this from watching it as a child. So.
Why do we not have Molly Sugden opposite Peter Davison?
Why wasn't she in this? We've had Beryl, yeah. I think, and we've had Ingrid. I really think she could have played a lovely Malice. She's got the hair.
We'll have Joan in a couple of years, for God's sake. Why not Molly Sugden?
She actually does drama really nicely, like all comedians do. So, yeah, it could have worked well. And she was smart. She would have actually known what was going on, unlike everyone else we've previously mentioned.
But Jane does a terrific job, I think. She's
Polly James. Yeah, she's good. No, she's lovely. This is another one of those stories when the doctor just seems to be so thrilled from getting to be able to get away from his own. Do you also notice, since we're talking about the church crypt, and this is Barry Newbury's last work for Doctor Who. Beautiful work on Marco Polo and the early days. But yeah, this is his last one. Newbury's did a lovely job on this. And I think it makes it very convincing. I think what's very sad, again, for the BBC is overreaching itself. And it always was about going further than you can, expectation-wise. But the physical effects of the Malice coming out of the wall, the whole thing, it just doesn't. And everyone's standing around waiting for a reaction. It's the same thing as sea devils waddling around with a mattress strapped to their fronts. It's not quite as menacing as you'd imagine that to be.
It's very funny that the monster is just part of the set.
Maybe do you think that's an ontological thing about how Doctor Who is just so trapped in a television studio and it's actually we're being destroyed cancerous-like from within by the set? Yeah, by the actual structure of the program itself. Can we mention people that, again, the Doctor is very happy. For the first time ever that I can remember, the Doctor says, I won't go up. We won't leave the TARDIS, boys and girls. It's much too dangerous. You stay in here where it's safe. Then the monster actually, Sutek-wise, like my cat, projects right into the console room and starts, and threatens them with green wallpaper paste. It's like he knew that was going to happen and he's really tired of both of them.
And I only noticed this time around with that Malice apparition.
Yeah.
They key it so it's the same colour as the TARDIS walls. It's like it's growing out of the walls.
Oh, I never got that. Yes, it is growing out of the wall. In the same way that it grows from the stone of the crypt.
Yeah.
Very clever, yeah.
It looks really good.
Shame that didn't come across on the screen.
Yeah, and we've got...
We've got 2 minutes because that's really all the time any of us can be bothered. I was just going to say with that one, I love that. I was just going to say that this seems like one of those grooming episodes, cough, cough, Doctor, where you seem to be looking for new people to travel with. If Will Chandler and Jane, Polly James, had joined the TARDIS, I don't think I would have shed any tears.
No.
Wouldn't that have been awesomeness?
So and especially her with Peter.
They're lovely.
They've got the same quality he had with Neris. And there's that wonderful bit where he sort of explains what's happening to her, and as he's about to walk out, she grabs his arm and says, "You must stop him!"
Yes,
I know.
Yeah. And Will almost... Actually, what happens? They take Will home. At the end of this, he's in the next story. Nah, not even a mention.
There's been a short trips story with Will, which... sort of Tegan and Turlough stay behind with Tegan's granddad and the Doctor and Will have an adventure.
Do you think that's the short story where Andrew Verney says to his granddaughter, "So, your Aunt Vanessa, how's she going?" And also the last time, who's the other relo
the
that
cousin.
She had?
Colin.
Yeah, and Colin, and how's he doing now?
I think
it's you, Tegan. I don't think it's us, I think it's you. Like to think the TARDIS chose her. And that there was a whole, way before Clara, there was a whole kind of, thread of...
There was a whole string of probable victims that the TARDIS has saved by removing Tegan from Earth.
Yeah, Janet.
Oh, dear. I was thinking about that myself. I like to think that his grandfather must be from the other side of the family.
Yeah, it's a maternal grandfather, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we presume so. Otherwise,
I think there's
some
line,
wouldn't he?
Yeah,
there was some line. Yeah.
The Auntie Vanessa is implied to be a paternal aunt because she says, your father's farm was hardly the outback. And it sounds like, she's talking about her brother rather than
her
brother-in-law.
And she dresses like a babushka doll. So,
So I think that's all we've got to say about The Awakening. So
I like this story, damn it.
Go on, why?
it has a real filming approach to the outdoor stuff.
It looks like an Adamant video, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the first scene is Jane peacefully wandering around these stables and then horses' hooves, peacefully wandering, and you think something terrible is going to happen, and then it's all this wargaming. Glyn Houston shows up again. You know, we haven't had him for years. Yeah, exactly.
Charlton-esque.
We have a cliffhanger, which is, you know, it's a stupid someone screams doctor long enough for the theme to kick in cliffhanger.
It's one hell of a great scream.
But yeah. Polly. She's really good. And, you know, unlike some other companion screams, it doesn't just sound like I'm screaming for a cliffhanger. It's like you're disappearing in a cloud of smoke to a giant alien mouth. I'm a bit scared by this.
Even though if you step 3 feet back, you're fine.
Yes. Yeah, what's it going
to
do?
All you need to do is...
Oh, you haven't seen that tongue.
Just put your hand in front of your face.
Yeah, it's a bit like what Dr. Soleil should have done last week instead of trying to karate chop the murker. A brisk walk will get you away.
All of them, actually. From that entire base was... you could have avoided the invaders just by, up on the pace.
I think they like to think that Malice Tongue could wrap around that church three times over and still leave room for a tickling stick. So you weren't that safe.
You said, Richard, that this story is about presenting us with two far more interesting companion characters, and the doctor then literally sends Tegan and Turlough back into a cupboard so he can take Will around a graveyard.
Yes. Where's Chameleon in this story?
Who's Chameleon?
I reckon Chameleon is Joseph Willow.
Is that Plague Face guy?
No, he's... He's the camp guy who threatens
to... Oh, Sir George's boyfriend.
Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing is, I was watching this going, you know, Sir George is being twisted by the malice and whatnot, and it's like, but Willow's just a dick.
Yeah, yeah. But we forgive him. He's in the TARDIS at the end.
Within that relationship, or do you mean?
But yeah, yes, at the end, no recriminations. He was arranging to burn Tegan at the
stake. He was.
But you know, we all have bad days.
You know, I think he must run the post office or something.
Because they're often very short-tempered people.
Yes,
he's got something on everyone. Oh, he's been reading Sir George's mail.
He runs the telephone exchange as well.
Yes. This is one of the few Doctor Who's that could very easily have been directed by Mel Brooks without any dramatic change.
I actually think you could drop this as a single episode story in the new series, and it would feel completely in place. It's, you know, it's not Blink, it's more Lazarus Experiment, but...
Like Lazarus Experiment.
Oh, so do I. You know, the science in it is Bobbins. Well, this is a bit Bobbins.
It is Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, though, I did have another chameleon thought, which is when Turlough first sees Will and just goes, "Who is that?"
So you think that's...
Will could be Chameleon. Why not?
Apparently Chameleon was going to get out and wander around the place.
Well, they filmed a scene with Chameleon in this story.
Another corridor moment.
Pretty much.
Going to get Mark Streakson to do the voice or something?
Yeah, well, it was recorded and Chameleon's accessing... Chameleon's accessing the computer terminal in the TARDIS, and Tegan says, "Are you sure you should be doing that?" And he responds in the Doctor's voice.
Oh, okay.
And she says, "Don't do that." And, "Would you prefer this?" He responds in Turlough's voice, "That's even worse."
Oh, God.
And it's the scene just before Tegan comes into the console room and, "What's wrong?" You know, et cetera, et cetera. Because Chameleon says to her, "Oh, there's something weird happening with the TARDIS. You should go to the console room." You know.
Bugger off.
It was really just a fluffy scene to say, yeah, we know we still got the robot. Yeah.
Terrible.
Turlough's solution with everything is to bash someone with a rock, have you noticed?
Who does he bash with a rock
this time? He bashes the people trying to get into the TARDIS after he escapes with Andrew Verney. They come back to the TARDIS and Willow and a bloke are trying to get in.
.com.
So Turlough whacks him on the head with a rock, just like he tried to kill the Doctor in Modern Undead.
First.
There are certainly problems. There's a problem which started a bit in season 18, and it's absolutely ridiculous this season. Caves of Androzani is the only story where other people don't go into the TARDIS.
Yeah, I hate that. I'm sick of that. And he's constantly going, I mean, next week he'll be going, "Quick, come into the TARDIS." It's like
Maud.
You know, it's that thing where he uses it to prove his innocence, like in Black Orchid.
Oh, God. I mean, that's terrible. Yeah. But, you know, last week it was kind of understandable and Preston did actually have an actor's reaction. This week, Jane has a bit of a reaction. Woolsey has a bit of a reaction. Tegan's granddad just goes, oh, okay.
There's about 20 people in there that final scene, all just standing around in front of the camera, all on one side of the console so that we can get them all in shot. It's really bad but boring, and it's like 5 minutes from the end.
I will say one other thing I would change about this story. You've got that bit where Willow and his mate have been knocked out and his mate wakes up and goes upstairs and gets decapitated by the Malice's last projection. It should have been Willow.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
he was rapey.
Willow, he'd just been nasty and unpleasant. He's not under any mental influence. It really should have been him instead of some nameless guard.
Yeah.
You know?
So remind me how he defeats the Malice. I have a feeling that the Doctor sits in the TARDIS and presses a whole bunch of buttons.
Yeah, he texts the tech.
And then it explodes.
Yeah, he texts the tech. I believe the explanation is that he cuts off the conduit for the Malice to receive emotion, and because the Malice feeds on emotion, that killed it.
But it was essentially pressing a lot of buttons and then telling us something had happened.
Yeah.
At least Joe got up in front of Azal and said, no, sacrifice me.
Thou shalt not pass.
You know, that was stupid, but it was at least someone doing something.
So stupid that it was the turning point of the entire plot.
And then Azal has like a mental feedback loop and goes all wibbly.
Like you do.
Whereas here, the Malice, which doesn't have a character, all it actually does is vomit and sort of breathe.
It's really just your basic 15-year-old fan.
Yeah. And goes...
Yeah.
More fat.
which actually is onomatopoeic for chundering, isn't it? According to certain fans.
Yeah. Oh. So, well, that's really all we've got to say about The Awakening today.
It's Michael Owen Morris's first gig directing Doctor Who. He was PA on Pirate Planet, which is not as rude as it sounds. Is this the point to mention that Pirate Planet is now out as a pre-ordering thing? Yeah. So one is excited about that.
Well, he did a terrific job of City of Death, I thought.
He did a lovely jobbies on that. This story was also called Poltergeist and War Game before
it
got the
title. I remember being called War Game.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think that we kind of know what it was reaching for and where maybe it didn't get. Do you think they were looking at what successes we've had? Again, we're talking about Doctor Who, really looking at what it is this year and what it has been, and being, I think, just a little bit too postmodern and self-referential, saying we had success with The Visitation. Let's do that, and let's also do a bit of Poltergeist and War Game. They're really name-checking what's been successful.
In the movies.
Yeah, at the time.
I mean, War Game would have been vetoed by... Did Ian Levine have anything to do with things now? You couldn't
have called it War Game,
given that there was the War Games earlier on.
He would have just had hissy fit. Yeah. I think the greatest ontological threat in this is actually the presence of Tegan Javanka. She obviously brings destruction, ruin, carnage, and leaves ashes where she treads in those stupid shoes.
She's wearing the same thing from last week, so she hasn't changed. Mucky, she's been through a giant massacre.
Mucky cow. I do. At least she changes her frocks. I wonder if Turlough actually ever changes his knickers, or indeed even wears any.
Tegan does add a handbag.
Handbag?
For this story.
In fact, it gets nicked.
Go on, do it.
Handbag. How the handbag got nicked is immaterial. But yeah, it's added simply so it can get nicked, and so the Doctor knows that the plague face victim...
Yes, is really into ladies' accessories. Yeah. I've never seen the second floor Grace Brothers. Are you being served? I've never seen Tegan with a handbag before.
Oh, no. Yes, you have. As a stewardess, she had her handbag.
Oh, that's true. That's her carry on. But that's just the mace and the cattle prod and the knockout. You know.
But this
and
isn't the same handbag. This is one of the Doctor's handbags that she's borrowed from inside the TARDIS.
Yeah, it is actually interesting that you know, since the Doctor. Oh, it could have been one of Susan's handbags.
Do you think?
As well, you know. Yeah.
Mm. It's this little round red number, but it's probably dimensionally transcendental.
No, it was Pertwee's handbag for sure. He had it in the Time Monster.
She gives herself a fair whack in the face with it at one point as well. Like, she sort of face palms and forgets she's carrying a handbag.
It's a strange scene.
Well, the thing is, it's entirely done so the guy can reach into frame and take it.
Are we playing the game of at which point does Janet and or Mark decide they're also leaving?
I don't think they're leaving in this.
Well, it was actually all planned out from the beginning of the season. Like during during the development of Warriors of the Deep is when Colin and Nicola were signed on. And I believe that Peter, Janet and Mark's contracts, I think Peter's contracts actually ended with the end of the season. I think Janet and Mark's contracts actually ended with Planet of Fire. But it was agreed they'd go earlier but still get paid.
So Janet was paid for Planet of Fire.
Yeah.
She didn't turn up.
But that's why she then came in to do a cameo for Andrazani. That was how the contract was honoured. But yeah,
and I really haven't watched that since the 80s. So,
but it was also decided to stagger the departures so each of the three got something with emotional resonance.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that is the three departures are one of the more successful parts of the season.
Yeah, no, they do. They finally get that stuff right-ish.
I actually quite like this season.
Are we jumping ahead? Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing to say about this stupid story.
Well, a lovely horse with a death wish for others because it cracked the ribs of not Glenn or Dennis. It did a horrible thing too. I think they should have just covered that in green paint and had it as the murderer. It would have been murderous.
Because in the studio.
It's the Lichgate scene.
Yeah, famous scene. So if you haven't seen it, dear listener.
It's still on.
It's on the DVD cuts. Extras.
Yeah. They still show it.
It was a male horse riding up. They put a mare on the other side of the gate so it would ride up to the gate. And the shot...
It's like the last episode of the first season of Kath and Kim.
The shot in the episode is actually the shot from the blooper just cut before the horse stops at the gate for a moment. Everyone jumps down and starts going through the gate, and then the horse continues through the gate and demolishes it. Thankfully, I believe the gate was a set piece set up by the BBC. So it doesn't matter in a way that it was destroyed. They'd already filmed everything with it. But, yeah, that's a famous Doctor Who blooper, along with Sylvester McCoy not being able to get a single line out in that scene of Delta and the Bannermen, which is, again, on the DVD.
Looking forward to that one.
So, yeah,
and that one with Bonnie Langford swearing her head off.
That still makes my eardrums peel to this day. That's really shocking.
That was just when she sees my cosplay.
Yeah.
So, okay, you guys have asked me why I like the story. Why don't you like it?
What story are we talking about again?
Mm-hmm. The Awakening.
Okay.
It's too much of a pastiche of everything else with nothing fresh. I do like the supporting actors. And I think there's a great deal. It looks lovely. And there's a lot of good performance work in this. And people are obviously enjoying themselves. Let down by the effects. Let down by, I think the oversimplicity of a pretty hackneyed plot and script that doesn't really do anything.
It's really just really forgettable. You know, there's nothing particularly memorable about it. The Marlis isn't that well realised.
Not at all.
The plot is really, really badly resolved. As I said before, you know, pressing the kill the Marlis switch on the TARDIS console is how we resolve it. And it doesn't really have any memorable visuals. It does mention a pteroleptal, but it doesn't have a pteroleptal in it. You know, it doesn't...
So that always gets a minus score from you, doesn't it?
Yeah, except for the actual visitation, which gets a massive minus scores for having pteroleptals in it. I just think there's really just nothing much going on here. And I'm almost certain that watching it for the podcast was the first time I've watched it since buying the DVD. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if I got home and discovered that the DVD was still shrink-wrapped because I was watching an electronic version. I may never have opened the DVD.
Well, have you opened the Gunfighters DVD?
Yeah.
Then you would have opened this one because it came in a box set with the Gunfighters for no readily explained.
Yeah, it's like two stories that no one very much cares about.
I think that's actually how it was described.
The box set was called Earth Story.
Earth Story? What's that?
Because much like Peladon Tales, these are the only two Doctor Who stories set on Earth.
Oh, okay. No, well, that makes sense.
Literally nothing they have in common beyond that.
We could call it floor sweepings, except the Gunfighters is really good.
It really is.
Yeah, they might as well have paired the Gunfighters up with Enlightenment because it got Linda Barron in it.
Linda Barron story. That would be a thing.
Actually, I do.
So are we getting her for a convention?
Sure. Actually, a lot of the stories this year have either been released or re-released in box sets. Like Warriors of the Deep was in the Beneath the Surface set. This was in Earth Story. Resurrection of the Daleks and Caves of Androzani were both re-released in Revisitations packs.
Oh, yes.
And Planet of Fire was released in the Chameleon Tales box. So the only stories to get individual releases this season with full-blown special features and everything.
Resurrection.
Frontios and Twin Dilemma. Resurrection and Caves did have individual releases, but they were early on, not as many special features, etc.
That's true. I've got the early on version stamped by Janet herself.
This is riveting, this stuff about DVD
It's much more exciting than watching the show, isn't it?
This is the kind of proper hardcore trivia that the FDA audience come to us for. Yeah,
well, I kind of wanted this to be in a box set. Like when Beneath the Surface came out and it was the first box set of non-contiguous stories, people were suggesting, well, hold on, why not put Black Orchid, King's Demons and The Awakening in a box set and have the like three Davis
the and the two terrible, don't want to watch.
Terrible historical adventures.
This is our last two-parter of the Davison era, and we've had two in the lead-up to it. We're not counting Resurrection of the Daleks as a two-parter,
even though
it kind of is. And none of them have been particularly successful, have they?
I think this is the most successful, but even I agree, the ending of this is rushed, and it's rushed just down to push the buttons, Max.
We've had that often before, though, haven't we? King's Demons has probably the most desultory ending of any story.
I said at the time, King's Demons ending feels like a part two cliffhanger. Yeah. We should have part three. I agree that this could have actually been just expanded a little bit and made into a three-parter, because we get that bit where Will crash tackles Dennis Lill into the Malice anyway. Mm. And it's like, well, why couldn't that have just been the thing that killed the Malice? You know, its focus is gone. And really, if you're pushing its focus into itself, that, you know, you can easily say, well, that creates a feedback loop because now he's terrified, but he's terrified within the terror and blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's still a bit of word peril, but it's not just the Doctor going, oh, flick a switch, oh, it's dying now.
No, it's an action, though. Do you know what I mean? It isn't quite word peril. You'd have to kind of sell it, but at least someone's performing a positive action that means something.
Yeah, and I will also say in this story, the death that occurs and the violence that occurs is actually commented upon, which quite often in this era when someone dies, you might get someone having a momentary reaction, but that's it.
Well, because usually so many people are dying that you just don't have time.
Whereas this, I think we just have the two deaths. We have that nameless guard who I mentioned earlier, and everyone's horrified by that, and they're screaming and what have you. And then there's Sir George's death. And I think what's really effective about that is the fact that Will does it, but then like is stumbling over himself to justify what he's done. And the Doctor has to reach out to him and say, no, look, it's okay. You're all right. And that is actually, it's quite effective because you get the moment of the villain dying, but it's not just throwing Gatherer Hayde off the roof and having a laugh about it. It's a real human has done this action and has done it for what he believes to be good. And it does destroy the creature, but at the same time, he's still a young lad. And he's said through all the way through the story that he's scared of fighting and the fighting's going to come here, and he's seen death and he's seen a Queen of the May burned at the stake.
Mm. The toast of Little Hodcomb.
The toast, yeah.
Or True Tom.
By the end of it. Yeah. That's Pete. You know, everyone sort of thinks Pete's sort of really bland and inoffensive, but that's probably the sort of grimmest thing. And more and more he's getting sort of grumpy and exasperated and running around the place. I think he's really good in this. We said he was good last week. I think that he's terrific in this. I love him exasperated. I think everyone
I know
thinks,
how he feels, though.
Yeah.
There's a wonderfully silly moment in this. It's a Doctor trying to sneak through the village, so he tries to go through the middle of the village where everyone is gathered up, and then he gets captured. And Sir George says, it's a pity you've seen this display of 30 people in the middle of the village where all roads meet. Yeah, we're obviously trying to hide it. It's not exactly a Wicker Tegan, you know?
But it is a Wicker Man, isn't it? I mean, again, maybe that's why this story you sort of feel. I love when Doctor Who plays homage, but not when it falls into pastiche. And there just isn't enough rebooting, or isn't enough heart of what we're doing here. Because there's some very strong Wicker moment. I love that Janet Fielding is Edward Woodward for this story, pretty much. She's playing the same part.
Does that make?
I'd like to see her reboot Callan. Yeah.
Does that make Keith Jane Jenny Agata?
Yes.
Because he does flash his chest about when he's running away at
yes,
one point.
Yes, he does. Yes.
And we have a Python-esque moment where he falls down in the long grass and then jumps up again. He is so adorable in this, and I don't just mean he's cute. I mean genuinely, his performance is adorable and endearing and sweet. And it really puts paid to that idea that historical companions are difficult to write for.
He's the first fresh, alive, real person I've seen, apart from Polly James, you know, pretty much all year. It's just interesting that they both turn out to not be given any more continuity in the show. Mm-hmm. He would have been, he's the Jamie we should have had all the time.
I think that would have been tiresome.
He would have dropped it like Fraser did. He would have mellowed out and perhaps even had a wash.
Mind you, I think we do see with 80s era companions, and really we can say JNT era companions, he tended to come up with the character sketch.
Literally three words. Yeah.
They get their character development in their first and last story, and then in between they're kind of anything.
This is true, isn't it? About and mouth. Yeah.
Do you know who I don't think
like
that's
this podcast?
True of?
What?
I think it's not true of Turlough. I think Turlough gets vastly less to do once his trilogy is over, but he still gets to be sort of cowardly, and he still gets to be unprincipled, and the
ginger
character is still,
in other words, just ginger.
Yeah,
we've had to deal with your ginger phobia on this podcast before, Richard.
Just wait until we get to Bonnie Langford. I do have to agree with you there, and I don't think it's in the script. I think it's in Mark's performance that, especially this season, he starts off being very cowardly, but he gets more and more reluctantly brave as the season goes on.
But he still gets devious and furtive things to do, and his body language always really sells that in a terrific way. I think he's good in a way that the high concept companions, as you point out, rarely are. They're introduced and they've got this sort of big backstory, and then they're being tied to railway tracks and menaced by Daleks.
He's into
soon
maths
afterwards. Maths is interesting.
She knows very little about Julie Byers Jenison.
They tend to just be shaved or skimmed off characters, so I guess they're
So it might be kind of a relief that we never got
stories.
That we never got Todd, as in Neris Hughes, Mariner, Will Chandler,
in
Jane Hampton,
Finnish series,
with
all together, it's the first time Barusa was experimenting with the time scoop, and he picked them all up and pit them against each other in a battle to the death in the death zone.
There's a lovely segue to revive Daypol Industries with action figures.
Chandler and Hampton and Strax,
brilliant.
With Nicholas Briggs as the voice of the Silurians.
Go on, do the voice. Do the accent.
Excellent, Will Chandler.
See, it works. It's like it's alive in your very own listening room.
Kill it.
Kill it now. Set fire to it. Poor Janet. I don't think it's going to end well for her. What do you think?
No, she'll be fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All her relatives are keeping well away. She's the Jessica Fletcher of
just without the cross-dressing nephews.
Oh, I don't know.
Jeff Conaway.
I was thinking Colin, but that's actually a cousin. But yeah, that's true.
Jeff Zach Allen of Babylon 5 Conaway was one of Jessica Fletcher's many nephews. And in his first appearance, his girlfriend, who Jessica Fletcher has flown out to meet him and his girlfriend. His girlfriend thinks he's having an affair, but actually he's performing drag in a club to save up money for the wedding.
Oh, that's
nice. That's lovely. Yeah. To Angela Lansbury.
To Angela, I mean, he's no longer with us. He was an oddly attractive man. A bit skinny.
Don't be thin-shaming.
Who was that terrible woman? Jeff Conaway.
So are we done?
There's a marvelous website.
I think there's a lot to say about this story.
There's a lot to say. There's a marvelous website called Angela Lansbury Tattoos. I think we've cited this before. You can go on to it. Just Google it. You can go on and see people who have had Angela Lansbury tattoos.
We'll have
one now.
Yeah, we could. Yeah. As we speak, yeah. So there is a lot to say about this story. Yeah.
We'll have to send that website to friend of the podcast, Joe Lidster, who is a fan of Angela Lansbury and biceps.
He's a good writer, too.
He is a very good writer.
Didn't write this.
Not even Eric Pringle wrote this.
Chips are too small.
They're really salty and unpleasant. Yeah. They're actually worse than The Awakening.
I agree. So I don't like that they're covered in green pea vomit. No, I don't like that.
Salty and unpleasant, the Eric Saywood story.
I'm not having the ship's biscuit, thank you.
No,
I'll have the spam. Called,
I don't know, what would it be called?
It's all John's
bile would be better directed against the enemy, Doctor.
It's all John's fault.
It's all John's fault.
Well, as we deal with audience complaints from having blown up another church, we're about to be sucked down into the depths of Christopher Hamilton Bidmead's script cupboard for Frontios next week. Until then, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Please leave us reviews on iTunes. We love to get them, and I, in particular, am a whore for attention.
heard that.
Speaking of which, don't forget Doctor Who in 10 Seconds, which I may update shortly on YouTube. Until next week, may none of you have difficulty explaining to your relatives why your aunt has been shrunk down to the size of an action man. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Angela Lansbury Tattoos, was recorded on November 19th, 2016. The next episode will be released on December 4th. If you'd like your very own piece of Tinklevic, just combine one part mercury to two parts Play-Doh, wrap in cling film, and make sure your health insurance is up to date.
Okay.
Oh, Christ, I've just looked up Angela Lansbury Tattoos.
We have to do this with, they're really good, aren't they? I mean, that goes on the website.